On November 30th, 1660, a dozen men gathered to hear the young Christopher Wren give a lecture on astronomy. In the discussion that followed, they decided to form a society for the study of new and still controversial experimental or natural philosophy. 2 years later, King Charles II made it his Royal Society. And in the 350 years since it was founded, its fellows have given us gravity, evolution, the electron, the double helix, the internet, and a large part of the modern world. In 2010, we celebrate 350 years of scientific brilliance and fearless doubt. That's what the Royal Society website says, right? And simply, of course, in light of these overwhelming achievements of one of the most successful scientific societies in the world, it is very easy to overlook the fact that there were preceding and concurrent organizations that were also dedicated to what was called natural philosophy in the 17th century. The Academia dei Lincei, literally the Academy of the Lynx-Eyed, you can see the lynx right there, but also known as the Lincean Academy in Italy, is classed as the first scientific society. Federico Cesi, on the left, an aristocrat from Umbria, founded the society in 1603, and it is named after the lynx, an animal whose keen eyes symbolized keen empiricism in the sciences. He is rather staring, isn't he? My goodness. The organization was also named after Lynceus, the Argonaut of Greek mythology, who is known for his sharpness of sight. The goals of the Lincean Academy were stated to be not only to acquire knowledge of things and wisdom, and living together justly and piously, but also peacefully, to display them to men orally and in writing without any harm. Cesi devoted the rest of his life to these goals and his academy, hosting his fellow natural philosophers in his house where he gave them room and board and provided them with books and scientific instruments. Pretty good. The most famous member of the Academy was Galileo, inducted in the spring of 1611 during his visit to Rome. The Lincei's most famous publications were also those of Galileo. This is his work on sunspots on the left, and you can see the lynx there dedicated very prominently in his portrait. And this is one of the few I see Galileo smiling. He always is scowling for obvious reasons. We see Galilei Lincio Philosophico, so he's very proud of his affiliation with the Lincean Society. At its height, the society had 32 members, including many in foreign countries. But as Cesi's academy was a personal academy, one rather than one sponsored by the state, when he died suddenly in 1630, the academy died with him. It was only revived in the 1870s to become the National Academy of Sciences of Italy. As in Italy, there was in England another nascent and largely forgotten scientific society. It also largely ceased to function without its founder. It met here in Oxford, in this very building, and it was called, appropriately enough, the Oxford Philosophical Society. It was active for 5 years, from 1683 until 1688. It's the only university scientific society of this era for which we have such extensive records. In this talk, I will describe the formation of the society and how it was bound up with the formation of the old Ashmolean building here, the direction of the Oxford Philosophical Society by Dr. Robert Plott, and the relationship between the Oxford Philosophical Society and the Royal Society, sometimes quite collaborative, and other times they were quite the rivals. The opening of the Ashmolean Museum led to the founding of the Oxford Philosophical Society. They're very bound up with each other. This Ashmolean opened in 1683. Robert Plott, the first keeper of the Ashmolean, directed the society. The building in which you were sitting in was the old Ashmolean Museum. Elias Ashmole, we see here, donating his collection of curiosities to Oxford once it agreed to build a home for it here in Broad Street. Ashmole was a royalist, and he married into money. He was a true Renaissance man, a collector of coins, books, and manuscripts, an expert administrator and lawyer, a historian of the Order of the Garter, a founder member of the Royal Society. He was also an alchemist and an astrologer, making predictions for King Charles II. In fact, we have many of his astrology books in the Bodleian Library. Samuel Pepys described him as a very ingenious man who loved to sing. Although, because of his emphasis on the inspection of particulars, traditionalists dismissed the Ashmolean when it opened as what they called a micnacatory that was even open to curious women visitors. The Ashmolean Museum that he founded was a symbol of the new science of inductive empiricism or observation that the philosopher Francis Bacon professed earlier in the century. A museum display was on the top floor, a school of natural history at the ground level, and as we see around us, a chemistry laboratory in the basement. In March 1683, at Ashmole's behest, Robert Plott was appointed as Oxford's first professor of chemistry and as keeper of the Ashmolean. The learned Dr. Plott, as he was called, was an ambitious man of versatile talents, without whose flair for organization and interest in natural history, the Ashmolean Museum may never have come to Oxford. Born in 1640 in Kent, Plott went to Magdalen Hall, Oxford. He obtained his BA in 1661, an MA in 1664, and a Doctor of Civil Law in 1671. He was a dedicated natural historian, writing both the Natural History of Oxfordshire and the Natural History of Staffordshire. I think the museum is having an event actually surrounding or dedicated to Plott's Natural History of Oxfordshire. It sounds very interesting. Plott's manuscripts in the British Library show us he was a dedicated chemist, au fait with the latest chemical theories proposed by theorists such as Paracelsus and the Arabic alchemist Geber. As was typical of investigators of his time, like Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton, Plott claimed that chemistry and alchemy could not be separated. Plott, for instance, was interested in finding something called the alchemical alkahest, a universal solvent that could break down anything into constituent bits of matter. I've always wondered, though, what kind of container they would put the alchemist in, right? We find in manuscripts in the British Library that Plott even signed a contract with a working alchemist that charged him to find this alchemist and to investigate the possibilities of the philosopher's stone. The contract promised that the alchemist would not use something called aqua regia to break down gold. This is nitric and hydrochloric acid. And then claim aqua regia was the alkahester universal solvent. This is an old trick that they tried to do, so this is to prevent fraud in an alchemical contract. In fact, if you look at a lot of 17th century history of chemistry, many of these contracts between alchemists and institutions such as universities and different royal courts existed. And the alchemists didn't produce a philosopher's stone, but sometimes they produced some very good methods for refining gold that were very profitable to the monarch or to the institution that supported them. We find also another document of articles of agreements regarding the matter of an invention for keeping and preserving flesh, fowl, and fish. And this alchemist is going to make some mysterious medical drops or some sort of quack medicine, all right? In addition to contracting with alchemists, Plott was also very interested in making as many contacts with the scientific world as he could. While the Ashmolean was being built from 1679 to 1683, and before and after Oxford had made provision of a meeting room for its own philosophical society, Plott maintained correspondence for the exchange of news of scientific interests with natural philosophers in London. Plott even served for a while as secretary of the Royal Society, and he was editor of its journal, The Philosophical Transaction, in the 1680s. The University Press, the Sheldonian, also did for a while the printing of the Philosophical Transactions. In this manner, Plott became very familiar with experiments that were being done in the Royal Society, experiments which he also was performing. Francis Aston, the secretary of the Royal Society, also sent Plott agendas for their meetings in advance, and many of his letters to Plott have survived in the Bodleian Library. For example, Aston wrote Plott on 8th February 1683. This is how he opens his letter. Quote, "I wish you good success in your trial of the restitutive power of a spring in vacuo boiliano." Well, that's an interesting phrase. What is he referring to? Well, Robert Boyle had done a series of spectacular demonstrations of showing a laboratory-created vacuum. Did these in 1660 and publicized them in a work called New Experiments Physico-Mechanico, Touching the Spring of the Air, his term for air pressure. And this is the apparatus that Boyle used to help him derive Boyle's law, inverse relationship between pressure and volume. We can see at the top a glass receiver and at the bottom a hand pump that would evacuate the air out of the receiver and create a partial vacuum in there, and you know, as much of a vacuum as they could create. And around here we see Boyle's description of all the parts that went into this machine. This was sort of like the cyclotron of the 17th century, very expensive to produce. But what's interesting, Boyle was one of the first in his publications to actually show us to this great of detail what he did with his machines, how he built them, what his scientific experiments were about. He really set the standard for later scientific papers, which allow other scientists to try to reproduce the results. He's one of the formulators of the standard. And so when Boyle did these series of experiments, the Royal Society got really obsessed with doing everything and anything they could think of in the vacuum pump, right? And we see this even got to popular culture. This is a picture done by Joseph Wright of Derby later, next century. But it's showing even members of the educated classes here are doing their own air pump experiments. We can see that the scientist in the middle has a cockatiel in this air pump, and they're going to evacuate the receiver. And the little girls here know what's going to happen to their poor pet. He's going to suffocate. They're in some distress, but it's all in the name of natural philosophy, isn't it? So they put everything in these air pumps. Marbles, cohering marbles, birds, mice, whatever they could think of, because people were interested in this idea that you could have an area of nothingness and vacuum in that receiver. So this is what Aston was writing plot about, this vacuo Boyleano. But then he continues in the letter and gets more specific. The vacuum experiment I hinted at was the pressure of a body suspended of a spiral wire in the vacuum, and in the air. Which how far they are the same, I will not answer, having seen nothing but a light glass ball hung at the wire. Now, when I first read this, I thought, what in the Sam Hill are you talking about here? I don't know what this is. And then I remembered. Robert Hooke. Robert Hooke at this time in the Royal Society was doing a set of experiments with springs by which he formulated Hooke's law. And it's a very easy law to remember. It just says it takes twice as much force to stretch a spring twice as far, right? But it is a direct mathematical relationship. And what he did is he hung a spring, he put a ball or a weight on it, and he tried to get a relationship between the weight of the ball and how far the spring stretched. And what they were doing in the Royal Society is they were doing this in normal air, but they were also sticking it in the vacuum pump to see if it made any difference. And this is what Aston was referring to Plot about. Now, there is absolutely no relationship between what we would call the spring of the air or atmospheric pressure and Hooke's law of the springs, but they thought there might be. And Plot tried to reproduce this experiment, and he wasn't really getting much of any results, and he complained to Aston about wasting his time with it. But this is an example of the interchange between Oxford and London and the exchange of scientific information. Plot, however, was eminently successful in getting the Ashmolean building completed. Under his guidance, the edifice of the Ashmolean was done, and the museum opened in 1683. The university disbursed the staggering sum of £4,540 in total costs, including £225 for equipping this chemical laboratory. That may not sound a lot to us in our terms now, but if you think to be an original subscriber to the Bank of England, you only needed £1,000. It gives you some idea what a fortune this was that they put into this building to equip it. It was an enormous intellectual and financial commitment to experimental studies in natural history at Oxford. Along with collecting and curating Ashmole's collections, which amounted to 26 boxes, some of 5 foot long, some 4 foot long, a yard over, and 2 foot deep, all filled, as he described them. Plott was busy soliciting other donations from virtuosi. One of his colleagues, Dr. Martin Lister, was giving the museum specimens from his own cabinet of antiquities in September 1682, particularly a pair of Roman altars that Plott really coveted. Plott wrote to Lister, "In the meantime, I hope you have taken good care about sending us the Roman altar stone which you promised to add to that noble collection we have already. Nor have you, I dare say, been unmindful of laying aside such things as you can spare towards the better furniture of my poor cabinet." I think Plott, as custodian, was starting to think about the collection of his own. He was certainly very proud of it. Now that he had a place and the trappings for his own experimental society to meet, Plott worked in earnest to form the Oxford Philosophical Society in 1683 and to link it with the Royal Society. The Oxford Philosophical Society, like many intellectual coteries at the Oxford colleges, was formed expressly for the more advanced scholars of the university. No one under the degree of Masters of Arts was permitted to join. Goodness. Plott regularly gave the Royal Society accounts of the scientific proceedings of his own ingenious assembly in Oxford to discuss problems of meteorology, physiology, chemistry, and mineralogy. Plott's colleague Martin Lister told him in a letter of October 1683, "I can assure you the best of entertainment at the Royal Society on Wednesday last was your letter. Your new Oxford Philosophical Society will be of great use. It will excite this other here, and emulation is the great promoter of learning." And the Royal Society and the Oxford Philosophical Society indeed did do a lot of collaborative research. An investigation of the close interaction between them was their joint experiments into the effects of the extraordinarily cold winter of 1683 and 1684. The diarist John Evelyn recorded that the ice split trees as if lightning struck. The icy seas locked up, stopping maritime travel. The fumes from citizens burning sea coal to keep warm was so thick that hardly could one see across the streets, and this filling the lungs with its gross particles exceedingly obstructed the breath so as one could scarcely breathe. The frost was a low point in the Little Ice Age, a period of low temperatures and few solar flares that were pronounced between the mid-16th and late 19th centuries. And the period between about 1680 and 1730 brought really cold weather to Europe. And one of the results of this was the Thames froze completely in London. It just froze very deep. And they had what they call frost fairs on it, carnivals. And this is a broadside from this year. And you can see that, we have bulls and pugs, and we have a bear baiting going up there. That's always nice, have a bear baiting, and a hog roast going on here. And there were a lot of people even, doing cart and horses because the ice was that thick. And there were even moralists at this time who said, well, it's all very well to go to the frost fairs, but remember, be careful because lots of slippery things happen on the ice, right? So the Royal Society and the Oxford Philosophical Society were trying to explain the effects on the health and other phenomena because of this cold winter. Several of the investigators, including Plott in the Oxford Philosophical Society and Dr. Martin Lister, who at that time was vice president of the Royal Society, decided to investigate this meteorological anomaly further with the use of instrumentation, using the barometer. Now, as we've seen, investigations of the air and atmosphere were a big deal at this time in the Royal Society, particularly after Boyle's work with the air pump. In 1665, Boyle coined the name barometer, which means weight measurer. Though Boyle postulated the spring of the air or atmospheric pressure was an explanation for the mercury going up and down in the barometer, and he was right, there was still some discussion in the society about whether this was true or a correct explanation. philosopher Henry Moore proposed the air had a self-propelling conatus, or what he called a hylarchic principle, something which Boyle said was really probably more a theological hypothesis and outside the sphere of natural philosophy. A few years later, the botanist and chemist Nehemiah Grew argued that barometric variations were due to not so much the mere weight of the air or atmospheric pressure, but he thought they were chemical in nature, affected by the changing concentrations of saline bodies in the air that affected atmospheric pressure. He says that the volatility of particular volatile salts in the atmosphere affected pressure and may have promoted storms. Lister's interdisciplinary interests in the weather and as vice president of the Royal Society led to him making daily readings of barometric pressure in the cold weather. And this led to his invention of something which we see as the histogram or the bar graph. And there was in November 1683 meeting of the Royal Society. It was said, I'll put up the picture because this is easier. Lister showed the way which he had made use of keeping his account of the barometer, which is approved of as very easy and convenient. He showed the book containing 3 or 4 years' account. Every table containing a month's account was printed off on a copper plate. So here's a copper plate. This is from the Boyle Papers in the Royal Society. We see on the right all the days of the month going down here, 1 to 31. We see at the top, Lister continues, the upper line contained the inches from 28 to 31 inclusive, each inch divided by lines into 10 part. That's the barometric readings. And the account was kept by drawing a red line at the height of the quicksilver at such a time of day. The account for the whole month was but one red line bending as the quicksilver rises or follows. And Lister said if you looked at this, you could tell what weather had been at any time. And he said he could do weather prediction by looking at the barometer, which is true. You can. You can start seeing if it's rising or falling. The topic of barometric readings was of great interest to many other Royal Society fellows like Boyle, continental scholars like Erasmus Bartholin, who made observations of the weather every day for 1671. Not only did weather observations appeal to the Royal Society's platform of scientific observations, but their fellows and colleagues hoped it would lead to other discoveries in natural history. In the late 17th and 18th centuries, the weather became to be viewed as less sort of a vehicle of providential intervention through singular events and more like a natural process that was accessible to human knowledge. Instead of recording unusual occurrences like comets and eclipses as divine prodigies or divine signs, the collection of everyday observations would reveal patterns of nature. Plot was enthralled with this, and so he gets this program going in the Oxford Philosophical Society. They join in the endeavor, and they record observations of exceptional weather by Lister's methods and then publish their results. And this is what Plot has to say. If we record weather observations, we will be enabled with some grounds to examine not only the castings, breadth, and bounds of the winds themselves, but of the weather they bring with them, and probably in time, thereby learn to be forewarned certainly of diverse emergencies such as heats, colds, dearths, plagues, and other epidemical distempers, which are now unaccountable to us. And he even thought that maybe we could even relate the weather to the positions of planets in relations to one another and the fixed stars. And by having this knowledge, we could prevent disease or other calamities. We certainly shall obtain more real and useful knowledge in matters in a few years than we have yet arrived to in many centuries. Met Office, watch out. I mean, this, they were talking about weather prediction. And they thought that maybe paying attention to the weather and occurrence of disease was also possible. This is something that went on because it was thought good and bad airs could affect the occurrence of epidemic disease. So this is another an area of endeavor. We can see the interrelationships between the Oxford Philosophical Society and the Royal Society led to quite significant developments in the gathering and presentation of scientific data. And generally, they could be quite collaborative. Sometimes, however, these close associations between the Royal Society and the Oxford Philosophical Society led to mutual suspicion and rivalry. A good example of this occurred over the publication of something called the Historia Piscium, or the History of Fishes, in 1685. The book was comprised of over 200 folio-sized engravings with quite extensive text, and its basis was the work of naturalist John Ray and the research of Francis Willoughby. So this fish book was going to be the ultimate thing in natural history. It was going to be one of the most lavish productions that the Royal Society ever did, an incredible amount of copperplate engravings, an incredible amount of expense, and the very best that they could offer in observations. In March 1685, Robert Plott, as head of the Oxford Philosophical Society, informed the Royal Society that John Fell, the Bishop of Oxford and founder of the University Press, would finance this fish book, provided that the book were entire as to the matter and to the figures, in other words, comprehensive, and that the Royal Society, if they would purchase 100 copies. Martin Lister, who was vice president of the Royal Society, was asked to, quote, give some instructions concerning the number of figures that would be necessary and out of which books they may be had. So Lister gets a hold of the author of the book, John Ray, and John Ray says, yes, it's a good project. As for this history of fishes, I can warrant it to be as full and perfect as the number of species. I'm going to give you all the fish that we know extant. You're going to have it all. As to the designs for the cuts or the illustrations, Ray claimed, I have several drawn from the hand from life and have already for every species made a reference to the place where the best figure of each fish is extant in other authors. And so he's using life drawings and he's using plates from other books. This is a time-honored tradition in natural history at this time, and he's choosing the best figure to indicate the morphology of fish for his taxonomic schemes. The following November, in the absence of Samuel Pepys, who was the president of the Royal Society at the time, Vice President Lister formally licenses the second half of the book, consisting of the illustrations, and the first part would be the text, and that was going to be the textual introduction supervised by John Fell at Oxford. So they're both going to work together to make this thing. Things seemed to be progressing very well until Robert Plott kind of dropped a spanner into the works. In a letter to Aston, Plott said, it had been presumed that Willoughby and Ray had taken all of the drawings of fish from the life, where it is now found that the cuts must be picked up here and there out of books. Plott and Aston had agreed before, they said, about the need for live models for the drawings. Aston had even mentioned before that he would even have preferred that it be printed with no illustrations at all, rather than permit old figures to be reused. And in the letter, Plott remarked that John Fell refused to go ahead with the fish project until all the drawings were sent for Oxford for him to peruse, and that in the bishop's opinion, one person should do all the engravings. Other than scientific scruples, it's not really quite clear why Plott was doing this. As the Philosophical Transactions had been printed in Oxford previously, with the engraving of his illustrations largely under Plott's supervision, it's possible he just wanted more administrative control over the significant publishing venture of the Royal Society. He also rightly may have surmised that the book would be representative of the Royal Society's achievements to date. Perhaps he wanted a little more publicity for the Oxford Philosophical Society's assistance in making this book. In the end, the Royal Society said, okay, we'll pay entirely for the book itself. The Bishop of Oxford will arrange for the printing of the text, the Royal Society for the illustrations, and the Royal Society then went ahead and created a committee to accomplish the job providing the plates. The book was published by subscription because it was very expensive. Each subscriber sponsored an illustration of a fish at a guinea each, and their names were engraved on the plate to recognize their contribution. So we have this specimen here, and Christopher Wren's name is underneath it. He gave a guinea to have that fish engraved. Okay. This one, Samuel Pepys, he's down here. Samuel Pepys is very generous in this. He had 50 of them done. He gave 50 guineas, which is a tremendous amount of money. But that was his gift to the Royal Society. All right? Now, as he was very experienced in commissioning engravers for his own scientific works, Lister was in charge of negotiating the prices for the illustrations, as well as ordering and seeing the completion of all these plates. In 1685, we see the society laid out on the table all of these beautiful figures of fish, 200 folio-sized engravings, and they're beautiful. I mean, the lamplighters look like they're ready to wiggle. The, you know, striped bonitos, distinctive markings are on there. These are gorgeous. And I can just imagine Lister sitting there tracing the engravings with his fingers, showing everybody how just marvelous these things are. We also see that the frontispiece of the Historia Piscium was sort of an emblem of the Royal Society and a connection to its founder, Francis Bacon. Philosophical founder, we'll say. This is on the left is Francis Bacon's frontispiece from the Great Instauration. And it shows us a ship going through the Pillars of Hercules, which was sort of the end of the known world. They were said to stand on either side of the Strait of Gibraltar, and they symbolized the journey into unknown waters and new knowledge. And in the distance, if you look on the left, I hope you can see that, you can see a second galleon returning to the in the distance, coming back from the new world of scientific endeavor laden with treasure, reinforced by the Latin tag on the bottom, which translates, many will travel and knowledge will be increased. In the Historia Piscium frontispiece, right here, we also see that we've got a ship which has brought back great treasures of scientific knowledge and great treasures of natural history from the New World, in fact. About 80 of the fish portrayed in this book, or 10 to 15%, were from the Americas. Also, we see a demigod here who is sketching live fish here. This may have been a gentle jibe to Robert Plott, saying, see, we do have live specimens in this book, Mr. Plott, yes. And to make the point even further, the frontispiece noted that the specimens that are live, and it's a little hard to see, but it's in the bottom of the sail, all the live specimens were marked with a cross symbol. And so some of the, if you see a little cross in the bottom of the fish illustrations in the book, this means it's sprung from the live specimen. So all that remains is for the book's copies to be printed. Lister was asked by the Royal Society to have 500 copies made in Oxford. As the plates for the illustrations were published and printed in London, and the text of the book was printed in Oxford under the supervision of Fell, the coordination of labor caused some problems and some suspicions. It seemed, looking at the archival evidence, that the Royal Society was accusing the Oxford printers, and hence by connection, Plott and the Oxford Philosophical Society, of some fraud, which is interesting. I'll get to that next. Sorry, I didn't have this slide up. In the Royal Society meeting of February 10, 1686, the minutes read, the debate about the history of fishes being entered upon, it was alleged by Mr. Aston, the Royal Society secretary, that the book being printed at Oxford and the plates in London, that there could be no fraud in the printer at Oxford. Against it was objected that the cuts being designed for a book apart, any number of the books that might be in the printer's hand might be that by that means be made complete. The council then agreed that they could not proceed to make any disposal of the history of fishes till they should hear from Dr. Plott and have security from Mr. Hall, the printer, that he had printed no more than the number which the society paid for. What they thought what was happening is that the printers at Oxford were publishing pirated versions of the Historia Piscium and selling them on the side, and that this was going on perhaps with Plott's complicity. Oh! Francis Aston subsequently fussed to a colleague of his, I have writ Dr. Plott about sending up the history of fishes, for yesterday a bill was sent us for the pay through the charges of it, and we were desired to lay the book perfect before the society. I desire you to take all possible care that the number of 500 be complete, because her reputation is concerned in it. Well, the books, 500 books are delivered. All on the surface seemed well. Ray was thrilled with the results, sure that the excellence of the illustrations would guarantee this book would be a bestseller. People were thanked for their involvement in the project. That proud moment was sadly ephemeral. It cost £360 to print this book. It was never recovered by sales, and the Fish book was no bestseller. It was expensive, it was part of the thing. The expenses nearly bankrupted the Royal Society. And in 1687, they paid secretaryship salaries to Edmund Halley and Robert Hooke with Fish books. We can't pay you a salary, so take five of these. Do your best. Lister's reputation in the society, because he supervised this, took a nosedive, and he licensed the book for publication, and he was not reelected vice president. In fact, he's no more to be seen very much in the Royal Society records. 4 days later, after Lister was not reelected, Robert Plott wrote to Lister a quite revealing letter. "Good doctor, I most heartily thank you for your last letter, though it brought the ill tidings of the frenzy of the society. Pray not be troubled by it, for the shame at last will turn upon their heads. I have acquainted my Lord Bishop," that's Bishop Fell, "with the whole business, who, together with his officers of the press, can and will justify us wherever there is occasion. I'll assure you I am so very little troubled at it that the joy I have contrived at the honor you do us here in desiring to be admitted of our Oxford Philosophical Society has quite overbalanced it. I hope Mr. Aston, Mr. Flamsteed, Mr. Tyson, Dr. Robinson, and some other good friends will follow your example upon this occasion. If so, my Lord Bishop has thought of a good design of advancing the reputation of this society in Oxford beyond what can be imagined. But of this say nothing. But bring in those men to follow, if you can, and you shall know all in good time. Nevertheless, I could not have you or any of the rest throw yourselves out of the Royal Society, for we may live to have a pluck with them for the authority thereto another time. However, we are sure to outdo them in all other matters. Next Tuesday, I shall propose you to be admitted a member of this Oxford Philosophical Society, which, as soon as done, you shall certainly hear again from your faithful friend, Robert Plott." Now, Plott's Philosophical Society, before the Fish book debacle, had been nothing but cordial. Plott had been secretary of it and saw the roles as complimentary. I think his attitude changed a little bit when the society accused a printer at Oxford of possible fraud. Plott had been heavily involved in the printing venture, having written the society about the character to be employed in the publication, it being recommended that there might be a border on the frontispiece of the Oxford Society's coat of arms, and he was insulted. This state of affairs is confirmed by another letter by Plott, which was read to the society on 3rd March relating to the history of fishes. You see this in Royal Society Minutes. "It seemed to the council that the answer of Dr. Plott argued some discontent in him. They thought for to write a letter to be written to him to satisfy him of the respect of the society and to remove from him all jealousies and misunderstandings about the affair of that book. It's clear by 1686 that Plott was perturbed by the Royal Society's Fish book debacle and saw an opportunity to take advantage of their weakness and compete with them by encouraging a sort of defection to his own philosophical group. Lister defected. He joined the Oxford Philosophical Society and had little to do with the Royal Society from that point onwards, whom he considered to be composed of men of mean and invidious spirits," from a letter he wrote. As for Plott, he hedges his bets a bit. He skillfully plays good politics. He kept Oxford Philosophical Society going for the next few years. He was even elected to the Council of the Royal Society on 30th November 1687. In 1687, he became the Duke of Norfolk's Secretary Registrar, so he's rising through the ranks. He becomes Historiographical Royale in 1688, but he decides then he's going to cultivate the life of the country squire. In 1690, he marries the widow of Henry Berman and left the university to live on his estate in Kent. In a letter to an Oxford friend, Plott wrote, "I've now left London and have set up my staff here in Kent. where I think to shake hands with the world and trouble it no more with natural histories or anything else. When Plot resigned as keeper of the Ashmolean, handing over the post to the brilliant Edward Clouet, he gave the university a large set of type specimens he had described in his natural histories of Oxfordshire and Staffordshire, and they were put in special cabinets, the Scrinium Plotianum Oxiensi and the Scrinium Plotianum Staffordiensi. After Plot's departure from Oxford, we note a sharp decline in the correspondence of the Oxford Philosophical Society. Part of this was the nature of the personality of Plot's successor, Clouet. Clouet was no slouch. He published the first book, a field book of English fossils. He founded the study of Celtic linguistics. However, as an underkeeper under Plot, he was prevented from going on field expeditions. And once he got the keepership, he didn't hang around here as much anymore. He went out and about, and he collected fossils and did his field work. Clouet certainly contributed papers to the Royal Society. He maintained extensive correspondences with their natural philosophers. But the Oxford Philosophical Society was not a project that suited his more introspective nature. Like Chizzy's Lyncean Academy, the Oxford Philosophical Society was Plot's one-man show, and was destined to be subsumed into the Royal Society. But if Plot held his post a bit longer, who knows? Perhaps we'd be celebrating the 350th anniversary of the Oxford Philosophical Society in 2033 instead. Thank you very much.